You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Let's start off reviewing the order in which our Gospels were written. Mark, then Matthew and Luke, then John, way down the pike. Because John has a different timeline, different theology, and portrays the characters so differently, scholars believe very little, if any, of Jesus' words in John are the authentic Jesus. We know that John was written long after Judaism was undermined by the Romans having destroyed the temple and after the Jesus people had been kicked out of the synagogue. Why were they kicked out? Because historically, there was a serious competition for adherence between the compromised remnants of Judaism and the Jesus followers. So, John, more than any of the other Gospels, discredits the Jews by making them the villains in the story. As such, you've got to be careful reading John, because it's been the source of justification for many anti-Semites to this day. As is common in scenes in John, the crowd is muttering against Jesus because they are literalists. In verse 42, the Jews base their complaint against Jesus' claim to be bread that came down from heaven on the fact that they've known him from his childhood. They know his family home, his parents, his earthly roots. John, though, is all about the more cosmic Christ. He has no infancy narrative or virgin birth scenarios and is unconcerned with Jesus' earthly physical history. Unlike the other Gospels, John emphasizes Jesus' spiritual and mystical characteristics. So in today's passage, John compares and contrasts the old manna in the wilderness experience of Moses and this new notion of a bread of life that is directly tied to Jesus. John takes advantage of the Jewish identity of the complaining crowd and recalls their own history. Those listening to Jesus begin to murmur against Jesus and his gifts of heavenly bread, even as the ancient Israelites began to murmur or complain against Moses, first out of hunger in Exodus, and then against the monotony of the manna diet in Numbers. And note, Jesus is not talking about communion here. He's talking about a mystical, spiritual understanding of who he is and the life-giving way of being that he has to offer.
Our words of wisdom are excerpts from John chapter 6, verses 35 through 51.
Jesus said to them, "I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never be hungry, and whoever believes in me will never be thirsty." Then the Jews began to complain about him because he said, "I am the bread that came down from heaven."
They were saying, "Is this not Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know? How can he now say, 'I have come from heaven'?"
Jesus answered them, "I am the bread of life. Your ancestors ate the manna in the wilderness and they died. This is the bread that comes down from heaven, so that one may eat of it and not die. I am the living bread that came down from heaven. Whoever eats of this bread will live forever. And the bread that I will give for the life of the world is my flesh."
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Ever gone grocery shopping on an empty stomach and without a shopping list? Everything that is the absolute worst for you looks especially attractive. And for a lot of people, the shopping cart ends up all ultra-processed food-like substances and not enough nutrition. Not to mention the sticker shock at the register. Shopping without a list risks spending your time and money on food that will not only be unfulfilling, it'll make you sick. And life is like that too. A smorgasbord of options competing for our time and attention. Too often our priorities have about the same foresight as an unplanned trip to the grocery store. And the things we end up giving priority to are not only not what we need, but bad for us. To have any control over our lives, we have to decide in advance what we will give ourselves to. Because without a plan, we end up with a cart full of stuff that may taste good, but leaves us spiritually empty. But there is a solution. You just need the right diet. High protein, sugar busters, Atkins, raw foods, keto, body type diet, caveman diet. Well, and then there's that really wacko option, the one John mentions in our passage today, the bread of life diet. Evidently, it offers full nutritional value. Jesus says, "I am the bread of life," and promises that people on his program will never hunger or thirst ever again. What? Why haven't the diet gurus caught on to this? It combines both low carb and high protein, right? Jesus says, "The bread, carbs, that I will give is my flesh, protein." Wow! Unless, of course, you're on a gluten-free diet. John evidently didn't count on you. I guess you're out of luck. Hang on. Literalism alert, right? But sadly, 2,000 years worth of Christians have gotten themselves tied in knots over this. When Jesus says, "I am the bread of life, and the bread I give is my flesh," he is not talking about bread or flesh. In John, Jesus calls himself the gate, the light, the vine, the living water, the shepherd, and none of those are literal. When John has Jesus say he is the bread, he is offering a way of life that sustains, nourishes, and fulfills. When he says the bread is his flesh, it's like you or me using the expression, "Let's get down to the meat of it." Not a literal meat, but the nourishing core of his message. Compassion, justice, radical hospitality. And remember, Jesus' words don't have anything to do with communion. Literalists are projecting that back on the story. The chapter begins with a telling of the feeding of the 5,000 where Jesus multiplies loaves and fish. The crowd, motivated by physical hunger, follows Jesus because he's giving away free food. So Jesus tries to redirect them and pivots from the physical bread to a spiritual metaphor. "I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never hunger." But the crowd still misunderstands, taking him literally. And I can't imagine how frustrated the historical Jesus would be with how far afield the church has wandered for thousands of years with arguments over whether communion is literally the body and blood of Jesus or not. At least John Wesley steered us a little bit back toward Jesus' original intention. Wesley said communion is a means of grace by which we experience the inclusive love and acceptance Jesus modeled when he shared meals with people. That's why we have a communion table and not an altar. That's why We welcome everyone at communion and don't require you to believe a list of unbelievable things to participate. That's why when we share the elements, we don't say the body of Christ or the blood of Christ. We say the bread of life and the cup of God's mercy. I think what John was trying to convey was that when we embrace Jesus as the bread of life, we are acknowledging that Jesus sustains us spiritually like food sustains us physically. Jesus being identified with bread embraces a symbol that says, what I'm on about, what I stand for in life, is a basic necessity for wholeness. It's soul food, if you will. And like any physical diet, spiritual nourishment only works if it becomes an everyday lifestyle. Be generous, care deeply, work for justice, show hospitality, resist vengeance, speak healing words. When Anna Quindlen gave the commencement address at Villanova University, she said, "People don't talk about the soul very much anymore. It's so much easier to write a resume than to craft a spirit. But a resume is a cold comfort on a winter night, or when you're sad or broke or lonely, or when you've gotten back the test results and they're not so good. So here's what I wanted to tell you today. Get a life, a real life, not a manic pursuit of the next promotion, the bigger paycheck, the larger house. Get a life in which you are generous. Look around at the azaleas in the suburban neighborhood where you grew up. Look at a full moon hanging silver in a black, black sky on a cold night. And realize that life is the best thing ever, and that you have no business taking it for granted. Care so deeply about its goodness that you want to spread it around. Work in a soup kitchen. Be a big brother or sister. All of you want to do well. But if you do not do good too, then doing well will never be enough." It's common sense that our spiritual lives are like our physical lives. A steady diet of junk food, unplanned and unexamined, is unfulfilling. It will never be enough. So we just cram more and more. When we share communion, we're not participating in something magic that completes us or getting some kind of spiritual inoculation. We're reminding ourselves that at the center of Jesus' life was a behavior, bringing people together around a meal that is more than just food. It's a symbol of what community can be like. People who in no other conceivable circumstance would be together, coming to share what they have. The rich and the poor, powerful and vulnerable, sick and healthy, strangers and friends, outsiders and insiders, weak and strong, oppressed and the oppressor, marginalized and privileged, young and old, learned and unlearned, the believer and the skeptic, gay and straight, able and disabled, the immigrant and the native born. As followers of Jesus, we are called to not only welcome to the table everyone who hungers for love, justice, and community, but to work to make the world a reflection of that table. How do we get there? By committing to the only diet that, in the end, really matters, Jesus' Bread of Life diet, where the minimum daily requirements for a whole and satisfied life are generosity and gratitude, faithfulness and curiosity, contemplation and action, and perhaps one of the most important elements, dissatisfaction with the way things are in this broken, hurting world. If you've ever been to our Monday-Thursday observance, you know that over the last few years, our communion elements include peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. Now, the Pharisees among you may join the crowd in today's passage and murmur and say, "That's not proper. That's silly." But consider this. While sacrament isn't a word we use every day, it's helpful to remember that it simply means making something holy or sacred, sacra, usually something very ordinary, like bread or wine. For those who come to Maundy Thursday, preparing PB&Js for the guys at New Leaf Shelter, and then blessing and sharing PB&J communion together, adds a layer of the sacred that makes it impossible to ever eat PB&Js again without feeling a connection to those who symbolically we were sharing the meal with. As one person observed, it made the PB&J a sacrament.
In 1965, a group of civil rights demonstrators were met at the Edmund Pettus Bridge by the police, who violently attacked them. That demonstration led Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. to call for a march from Selma to Montgomery in behalf of voting rights legislation then before the U.S. Congress. So a march began from Selma to Montgomery. At the time, I was a social action executive for the Massachusetts Council of Churches. My job was to help organize and send people to that march. But I and others at the Mass Council joined the march on the day before the last day. We were driven to the site of the march after we arrived at the airport, and I spent the night on my raincoat on the ground at the St. Jude Catholic Complex. That next morning, we began that last phase of the march into Montgomery. A decision had been made that when we approached Montgomery, we would take a jog to go through the black community as a show of solidarity and support. I was on the outside and looked down the line of march, and as we were walking along, I could see an African-American woman coming up the line of march, counter to our direction. She looked to be a woman who had known a lot of poverty. Her dress had been washed many, many two times. Her shoes were old and well-worn. But in one hand, she had a gallon jug of Kool-Aid, and in the other, she had six peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. I don't know why, but when she got to me, she shoved those sandwiches into one of my hands and that gallon jug of Kool-Aid in the other. And then she looked at me and said, "Hell, brother, we're going to overcome." Well, when I looked back up the line of march, she had gone. But I took one of those peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, passed them to the person next to me in the line. Then I took that gallon jug of Kool-Aid. I was always proud that I knew how to drink from a jug. Then I handed that to the person next to me in the line, and it just hit me. This is my body, broken for you. This is my blood, which is shed for you and for many. That remains the most powerful Eucharistic moment of my life. I chilled for a mile after that, and we continued that march on into Montgomery. Once there, in the front of the Capitol, we began a long demonstration. And there we all sat down on the grass, thousands of us. As usual, we had singers and musicians. We had speeches. It was a rousing time together. And yet we all waited for Dr. King because we knew he would bring the message that would close out the event. Finally, the time came for Dr. King's speech. I still regard that speech in Montgomery as the equal of the one that he had made in Washington in 1963. And when Dr. King enters into the last part of that speech, he began a kind of a call and response with himself initially. He shouts out, "How long?" And he responds to himself, "Not long. How long? Not long. How long? Not long, because no lie can live forever. How long? Not long, because while the arc of the moral universe is long, it bends toward justice. How long? Not long. How long? Not long." Then he shouted at us, "How long?" And those thousands of people got up off the ground and on their feet and shouted back, "Not long." It would be 3 years before his body would be broken and his blood would be shed. But as long as I live, I shall never forget that wonderful black woman shoving the elements of the Eucharist into my hands and then proclaiming, "Hell, brother, we're going to overcome."
It seems like today, every day, we're presented with more to overcome. The rolling back of basic rights, the casual cruelty of our political and religious leaders, and the mistreatment of the very people Jesus told us to care for. If we're paying attention, and if we have a genuine conviction to grow spiritually, we cannot be satisfied with the way the world is. We know that virtually everything in our culture tempts us to fill our lives with things that are not really filling or fulfilling. When John has Jesus say, "The bread that I give is my flesh," he's not giving us a recipe or a literal menu, but he is getting down to the meat of it. We will only be fulfilled, we will only be sustained when we take Jesus' way of living into our own bodies, into our own daily routines, and make his compassion, his justice, and his mercy the very fiber of our beings. All of you want to do well, but if you do not do good too, then doing well will never be enough. Communion is not some magic ritual that purifies us as individuals. It's about reminding us that we're all in this together. It's about steeling us for the work of overcoming the superficialities of life and giving us the strength and courage to do, ultimately, the only things that will be satisfying spiritually: seeking justice, loving generously, acting boldly, and every day making every encounter with others holy. When Jesus says, "I am the bread of life, you will be filled," it's shorthand for saying, "Take me to heart. Do what I do. Love one another. Welcome the outcast and the stranger. Speak a healing word to the hurting. Liberate those who are captive. Stand up for those who are oppressed." And like any diet you take on, it only works if it becomes a lifestyle, not something you just do occasionally, apart from the daily grind, but something you practice every day. As we seek to do good, as we seek to follow Jesus' lead, we make the everyday holy, and we put flesh on the claim that Jesus is the bread of life. Be well. Don't forget, if you liked what you heard today, buy me a coffee. The link's in the description.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information Or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.